Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
If I Must Die by Rifat Alaria, November 1st, 2023. If I must die, you must live to tell my story, to sell my things, to buy a piece of cloth and some strings. Make it white with a long tail, so that a child somewhere in Gaza, while looking heaven in the eye, awaiting his dad who left in a blaze and bid no one farewell, not even to his flesh, not even to himself, sees the kite, my kite you made, flying up above, and thinks for a moment an angel is there, bringing back love. If I must die, let it bring hope. Let it be a tale.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried. And I decided to begin the program a little differently today. That was a poem entitled If I Must Die by the Palestinian poet Rifat Alarir. And it was read by Brian Cox, the Scottish actor. And Rafat Alarir is no more. Like so many Palestinians, he has been killed. Like so many Palestinian inhabitants of Gaza. Since October 7th, since the onset of this barbaric onslaught by the Israeli apartheid state on Palestine as a whole. Like so many men, women, and children, Rafat Alarir is dead. He has been killed. He's been murdered. But his words survive. What he left behind, his students survive. And if you want to know, more of far more about him than I can talk about here, far more than I can outline for you right now, I would definitely encourage you to watch this past week's episode of the Electronic Intifada podcast with Ali Abu Nima and Nora Barrows Friedman and all of them. They basically talk about their interactions with Rafat, how he changed their lives, and how he... And you hear from all his students and all these people who he empowered, all their lives he touched, and how he taught them to raise their own voices in resistance against this occupying behemoth that is trying to crush them and crush every Palestinian. And Rafat Alarir, I mean, he was a brilliant academic. I mean, he trained at Cambridge. He got a PhD in Malaysia. He could have gotten a university position almost anywhere in the world, but he chose to go back to Gaza because he believed that there was a vital task he needed to carry out. He needed to train, he needed to educate, he needed to empower a new generation of Palestinians to give them a voice, not just in Arabic, but also in English. To speak the truth of what it meant to be Palestinian, of what was happening to them, and of their hopes, their dreams, their aspirations, their souls, their culture, their nation, all these things he needed them to communicate. That was resistance, a form of resistance he could facilitate. He could empower them, and that's what he did. And he touched so many lives. So many students passed through his classrooms over the years. Heard on the Electronic Intifada podcast this past week. Heard from many of them. Very moving testimonies of how he changed their lives. And of course, he was a brilliant poet. If I must die, that's only one poem of many, many, many poems that he did. Many writings that he did. One book you may know, which he edited actually, called Gaza Writes Back, which is a compilation of Palestinian short stories written by inhabitants of Gaza, many of whom were his students, written in English, and that was released to great acclaim, I believe in 2015. Now, and though Rafat was killed, along with, I believe, about six members of his family in his hometown of Sejaiya in the southern Gaza Strip, which is now being invaded and destroyed by Israeli troops. His spirit, his passion, that spark which he wanted to impart to his students, it remains. And I normally don't play TED Talks on this program for obvious reasons. But in this case, I'm going to make an exception because Rafat Al-Hariri actually organized a TED Talk series in Gaza in late 2015. So this is about a year after, the terrible Israeli onslaught on Gaza in 2014, which devastated the whole area and killed many thousands of people. But he actually organized a TED Talk series in his hometown, Shejaia. There was actually a TEDx Shejaia. And he spoke. He spoke there about the power of stories. And this is something that really speaks to me as an author, myself. And about the power of stories to, as resistance, as a means of fighting back against this apartheid system, which is trying to crush you, crush your mind, crush your will to fight, your soul, your culture, everything. And stories that are passed down from generation to generation, they are a means of fighting back. They are a means of transmitting, information, passion, like who you are, like the very essence of your identity and nation. And he said, this goes to the core of what allows Palestinians to fight back and to continue to resist after decades and decades and decades in the face of overwhelming odds. And this is something that speaks to me also as someone of Irish descent. This is something that is a very key part of Irish culture and tradition. One of the reasons why Ireland is one of there's so much solidarity with Palestine and Ireland. When you have that kind of resistance in your culture, as long as you have it there, you can't be broken. And Bobby Sands, the great Irish poet, he was very much a testament to that. He died for his people, for his cause on hunger strike, as so many Palestinians have. And they knew what they were fighting for. They were willing to make the ultimate sacrifice for it. And regardless of what the oppressor, what the, the apartheid system, whether that was in Northern Ireland or it was in Palestine, tried to throw at them, they would not be broken. And Rafat would not be broken until the end. He fought until the end with his pen. And this talk, which was given in November 2015, this TED talk, this is where he talks about the power of story. So I want you all to listen to this and take it to heart. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Hello, everyone. Today, my speech is going to be about storytelling. I'm not a great storyteller to the masses, but probably I try with my kids. I brought Omar. He's my eldest son. I always spend most of my time with them, telling them stories, either about them when they were kids, myself, my mother, my grandmother, and sometimes we make up stories. And I invite them to tell the story and retell the story. Sometimes on purpose, I start a story when one of the my kids is absent, so that I can watch them retell the story to each other, and the results are always amazing. The topic of storytelling is something I am interested in as a Palestinian average man and as an academic at the Islamic University. Something that happened to me last month when I went with my friends to Gaza seaport to buy fish. Of all the types we had, we have very limited types of fish, but there were still a few. I liked one particular fish. It's the swordfish. I don't know why. I went to that particular fish. I took pictures and took more pictures, and I almost carried it and asked my friends to take pictures of me and of that particular fish. One of my friends said, why this particular fish? I didn't answer. I didn't know why. But I felt this bond, this strong connection between me and between this type of fish. When I went back home that day, I started thinking of why I did that. When all of a sudden, I remembered something my mom told me as a kid, a story about a swordfish, in which a group of fish were caught by a fisherman, and it was the heroic, the brave swordfish that managed to free them, set them free. Apparently, my mom was teaching me patriotism, bravery, to stand for one's friends, to stand for one's family, to stand for one's homeland, to stand for, to struggle for rights, to struggle for the people around me, the ones I love and the ones I know and the ones I don't know. And so many other stories also rushed to my mind. One of them is the story of the cat, about a lazy boy whose mom asked him to go out and check if it was raining. He was too lazy to stand up, probably watching TV. And he said, "Mom, let's wait for the cat. When it comes back, we can feel the cat. If it is wet, then it must be raining." She told the story to me again and again and again. Probably she wanted me not to be lazy. Maybe I'm not lazy, or I'm not very, very lazy. Thank God my wife is not here to tell you. But I also remembered stories that, other than the fictional stories my mom told me, real stories about me. And that's me when I was a kid. One of my friends was joking that if the people are not going to laugh after your jokes or your stories, they're going to laugh at your pictures. I don't know. My mom told me so many stories when Israel invaded Gaza, of herself going to school despite the fact that the bombs, the shells, were raining all over the place. And one particular experience still makes my hair stand on end. She told me how she narrowly escaped death when she was going to school one day. And the other day, she woke up, she took her bag, and she went to school. Nothing stopped my mom from going to school. And probably for that reason, I have never, ever in my life missed a class or skipped a class. Unless Dr. Ayman Al-Hallaq is here, then maybe I skipped one class. And I started thinking of these stories, and I realized that I am the person I am today because of these stories, because of my mom, because my mom was teaching me values, was teaching me etiquette, was teaching me to love people, to love my life. She was teaching me to love my country at the same time. I started also thinking of my early memories. And I went to my mom that day and started telling her of particular experiences that keep flash into my mind. When I realized something that I haven't paid attention to before in my life. She told me, "Rifat, it's impossible for you to remember this because you were 1 or 2 years old." And then I realized I must have lived these stories. Well, despite the fact that I can vividly describe these stories, I must have lived them through my mom's stories. So her experiences, her life became my life. And that's how my life was shaped. Stories are also important in our lives as Palestinians, as people under occupation, as native peoples on this land, not only because they make us, they shape us, they make us the people we are, but also because they connect us with our past. They connect us with our present, and they prepare us to the future. I also remember my grandmother, bless her. Every day when we were kids during the First Intifada, every day for years and years, we would spend the evening at our grandparents. My grandpa would be ready, making the best tea ever. And the best thing about him was he would always add as much sugar as we wanted. That was the best thing in our lives. But when we finished the tea, when we finished the sugar, we would leave our grandpa and turn to our grandmother for her stories. Because that is what we always waited for. our grandmother's stories. And no matter how much more sugar our grandfather added, we never left her side. We never left her side because that was the best day of our day. My grandmother was clearly exercising power over us, was clearly competing with the fact that our grandfather always wanted us around him, and she always won. Our grandmother always won. Now, the serious question here is when our grandmothers tell us stories, they tend to inject these stories with values, with meanings. Sometimes we do this, we inject things, but our grandmothers, our moms, they speak spontaneously. They speak from personal experience. They tell us stories about their own lives. They describe life beyond the armistice line, for example. For example, my grandmother told us stories when she was a kid, when she was a newly married wife who would spend months plowing her land, harvesting the crops, the land that now we don't own because it was occupied. Although the land is physically occupied, it still lives in our memories. It still lives in our hearts because we can easily visualize this. And this makes me always think of Suad Al-Amri, the wonderful Palestinian writer. She said when she went back to Jaffa, she has never been to Jaffa before. When she went to Jaffa, she said, I could tell whose house was that and whose shop was that. And I could tell what happened to my mom here and what happened to my dad there. Because I lived these experiences in my own mother's stories. However, some of these stories are dying out. Because the old are dying. And also because we stopped caring about these stories. That is unfortunate, but it is true. We spend too much time on TV. And we spend too much time gazing at our smartphones. Even when we go visit our grandparents or our parents, we're usually busy gazing at our websites, at our smartphones. We don't care as much as we used to care in the past. And that is very dangerous. Now, Edward Said warns of this. If we stop caring about stories, if we stop telling our stories, if we stop listening to our parents, we create space, we create vacuum for others to occupy this virtual space in our past, in our heart. Edward Said says, history is made by men and women. And I love the fact that he refers to this, the fact that this is something made by women and men, not leaders, not politicians, not the elite, because the history, the oral history for us Palestinians belongs to you, to me, to our mom, to our dad, to our grandparents, to your parents and to your grandparents, because the oral history should always belong to the people, should shape politics, not the other way around. History is made by men and women, just as it can also be unmade and unwritten in case we just leave it and keep silent. And this also takes me to an amazing story of a native Canadian. When the colonizers took over North America and they wanted to divide the land among themselves, one of the eldest approached them. He asked, "What are you doing?" He said, "We own the land. We are dividing the land among ourselves." He said, "If this is your land, tell me your stories. If this is indeed your land, tell me your stories." And of course, the answer is silence, because they had no stories and they don't own the land. And it also takes me to Africa. And I love how talking about oral history and storytelling connects indigenous native people from all over the world. Chinua Achebe teaches us something. This is a lesson for us all. If the lions do not have their own historians, the history of the hunt will always glorify the hunters, will always glorify the occupier, will always glorify the colonizer rather than the colonized, the oppressed, the indigenous, the rightful people of the land. And believe me, people out there are looking forward to our stories. They want our stories. They seek our stories. And this is the very amazing success story of Gaza Rights Back, which is a book. Gaza Rights Back is a book of 23 stories written in English by young Palestinian men and women between the age of 17 and 25. 13 of the 15 writers are females. 13 of the 15 writers are women, are young women. And this again takes me back to the fact that my mom made me. My mom made me the man I am because of her stories. And my grandmother made me love my country, my homeland. And we have more women telling stories than men nowadays. Gaza Rights Back was translated into 6 languages, was published in America, and it is all over the world. Because, not because of the book, but because of the stories that the young people managed to write, we have been contacted from people around the world, as far as Japan, Brazil, people in Italy, in South Africa, people in Malaysia, in America, in Canada. We've been contacted by those people, and we spoke about our experience as Palestinians because of the power of the story. Let's tell more stories. And sometimes when we tell stories about our homeland, we love the story because it is about our homeland. And we love our homeland even more because of the story. What now? What should we do? What should be done? Let's go back home. And when we go back home, let's talk to our parents, to our grandparents. Let's approach them. Let's seek their stories. Let's beg them to tell us stories and to tell us more. And when they tell us stories, let's carry these stories and tell them to our little ones, to our kids, to our boys, to our girls. Because if we don't do that, if the story stops there, we're betraying ourselves. We're betraying the story. We're betraying our parents and grandparents. And we are betraying our homeland. Thank you very much.
It's a song that encapsulates exactly why the struggle has went on so long, and we have endured, and we have came out the other side, so near your victory. The higher you build your barriers, the taller I become. The more that you take my rights away, the faster I will run. You can't deny me, you can't decide to turn your face away. No matter, cause there's something inside to stop. I know that I can make it, but you're doing me wrong, so wrong. And if I'm in, my pride is gone, oh no. There's something inside to stop. There's something inside to stop. The more you refuse to hear my voice, the louder I will say. You hide behind the walls of Jericho. Away, 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 away. Your lies will come tumble. You squander wealth that's mine. My light will shine so brightly. It's gonna blind you, cause there's something inside to stop. I know that I can make it, but you're gonna be wrong, so come, oh no. There's something inside so strong, something inside so strong. Sing, brothers and sisters, when the incense fear to stop getting up. Oh, but we know better. We're gonna look them in the eyes and we'll say, we're gonna do it anyway. We're gonna do it anyway. We're gonna do it anyway. Cause there's something inside so strong. Make it, but you're doing me wrong, so wrong. And you thought that my pride was gone. Oh no, there's something inside so strong. Something inside so strong. Something inside so strong. There's something inside so strong. Thanks very much, Brisbane. Cheers.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Gary Ogg, the Irish singer with Something Inside So Strong. And Rifat Al-Arir, you know, like he... That's what he was building inside his students. That was what he was encouraging. That was the strength he wanted to encourage to take flight. And there were many of the tributes on the Electronic Intifada that I mentioned, you know, after he was dead, after he was killed, he was murdered by the Israeli apartheid onslaught in Gaza. Many of the tributes from his former students, you know, they compared him to a phoenix. Like his spirit was that of a phoenix rising from the ashes. And you cannot kill that. The apartheid system and its imperialist backers in the United States, in the West, they can't kill that. They can't kill that. This Palestinian who was fighting for his homeland and who wanted to empower his homeland and his people. Just like the British government could not kill the spirit of the Irish nation and its fight for freedom over many, many centuries, many generations of poets, of warriors. You know, this is apartheid. I can't take that from you. It cannot crush you. It, you know, that spirit there, you know, the same spirit that animated Bobby Sands, animated Rifat Al-Arir. And that spirit is going to continue. And it really is a war of liberation. This is a struggle for liberation. That is undeniable. Like what's going on right now in Gaza, in Palestine. And this is something that was discussed on the Electronic Intifada very well by one of its regular contributors, John Elmer. On the episode of Electronic Intifada, that the podcast, which came out on December 3rd, he talked about the nature of the struggle. You know, where you have like resistance fighters in Gaza squaring off against tanks, against Israeli tanks, you know, and heavy armor and all this, you know, just crazy sophisticated technology. And yet you have like these very lightly equipped like resistance fighters going in there and standing up to it and fighting against it and just showing the most remarkable bravery. Just incredible bravery. Like standing up against this machine which is trying to crush them, but it can't crush them. You know, it continuously fails to crush them. And they keep hitting back and they keep, you know, they keep doing damage. They take these tanks out, you know. They inflict casualties. They drive the Israelis back. They make them pay the price for trying to invade and destroy the Palestinian homeland. It's resistance. It's a war of liberation. And this is what John Elmer talks about in the Electronic Intifada podcast. So I want to play that clip right now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
You pointed out, John, that these videos also tell us something else. And in that one clip we just saw, we saw the Qassam and I think Saray al-Quds fighters as well. So what was important there was that they appeared together, which showed that they're still able to communicate and coordinate. Saray al-Quds, of course, is the military wing of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and they fight side by side with Qassam, and they coordinate all their actions. But the fact that they're able to demonstrate their presence on the streets of Gaza City in areas which a week ago were occupied by Israeli tanks or in areas where the Israelis are still very, very close. Now, I want to shift, John, to a question in the last few minutes that we have. To what happens if the truce is not renewed? Right now we're in a 24-hour extension that is set to expire. I believe it is 7 a.m. local time in Gaza on Friday morning, and that will be a week exactly after the first truce started. There are talks going on right now about a further extension. At the same time, Benjamin Netanyahu is vowing that Israel is going to achieve all its objectives of destroying Hamas. He said that publicly after U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited today and once again voiced the caution that we've been hearing in recent days from the Biden administration. I do not want to absolve the Biden administration one bit from its complete involvement and complicity in this genocide. Nonetheless, in recent days, they seem to be getting cold feet. They're telling Israel, well, if you do resume and if you go into southern Gaza, we don't want to see the same level of forced displacement and killing of civilians and so on. So if the truce is not renewed, John, what are we looking at in terms of the resistance, in terms of what Israel may do? I'm conscious that neither Hamas nor the Israeli command are sharing their plans with you. But what do you see here in the minutes that we have?
I mean, I think just on the humanitarian, to start, if Israel's going to wage a ground invasion into the southern part of Gaza, into Khan Yunis, where Mohammed Deif and Yahya Sinwar are from, and they've already pushed everybody out of the north, so now there's 2 million people trapped in this tiny corner of the Gaza Strip. When Israel invades, it's going to be brutal. And I just find it hard to even imagine that that's going to happen. But there's what's Israel's way out of this? The only accomplishments they've had are blowing up the parliament buildings, which the prisoners were just released like a block away from. They sent their special forces in to, according to the IDF, assault Shifa Hospital. They just celebrated them during the truce, the guys that went in and take Shifa Hospital. They've doubled the number that they said they killed. They've been going with 1,000 to 2,000 for the last couple of weeks, and they doubled that to the Economist. They said 5,000. They've killed 5,000 fighters. So even if we say that's true, you're still talking about 35,000 or 40,000 other fighters that are all going to be concentrated. I mean, if they're going to fight in the south, they've cleared the entire north. Which they said they were clearing it to fight. But apparently, if they're going to invade the south, the point of clearing the civilians out of the north wasn't to clear the battlefield to have a face-to-face fight and to eradicate Qassam. It was obviously just a targeting of civilians. Otherwise, we would be talking about the war that's about to happen in the north, because the first stages, this is only the first stages of a ground invasion. And to push the civilians out, it's supposed to be to presume that you're going to then fight on that battlefield, but it's clear that there don't seem to be preparing to fight in that. They're preparing to now attack the area they told everybody to go to. And so I think that you can imagine, even if we take Israel's numbers, say 5,000 were killed. So where's the 35,000 other fighters? They're all concentrated, ready to fight and defend the area that Israel's going to invade next, because there's no reason to believe that Qassam threw all of their most important assets at the initial invasion, which we've said before. And so somewhere in this, if Israel's actually trying to eradicate Hamas and not just kill neonatal babies, they're going to have to, at some point, be willing to get out of their tanks and fight face to face and take hundreds and to take thousands of casualties to do it. And I think what Tarek said is what I fear as well, that we're talking about tens of thousands of more people dying. And Blinken is sitting, doing good cop, bad cop. But what is there behind the scenes? Did Blinken tell Israel, you get 50,000 deaths, you get 20,000 dead kids for one event in the south that your army should have repelled but couldn't? What's this number? Like, what is the number where Blinken says, okay, that's enough. You've killed enough women and children. You've starved enough people. You've given them waterborne diseases that are spreading and killing.
The terrifying thing, John, is I think for the likes of Blinken, there is no number that's high enough. Because, again, I go back to Ukraine, where Blinken, who seems to be in charge there because Joe Biden, it doesn't seem to really be aware of too much. Although I think he's not fit to be president, but he is fit to stand trial, is the way I look at it. But you know, when it comes to Ukraine, the Americans are still throwing Ukrainian bodies at this impenetrable Russian army, and they just don't care how many Ukrainians are killed. So when they
Those are soldiers that are prepared to fight. This is a number that we're trying to come up with. Is it 50,000 dead civilians? Because they're targeting civilians. They've only killed a few thousand fighters at this point. And that number probably isn't even true, because we haven't seen signs of that.
I think they'd show it. They'd be desperate to show it.
And there's people all over the north.
If not through their official channels, they would be leaking it out through these Telegram groups that are populated with Israeli soldiers and so on. Even if Israel didn't want to get its PR hands dirty, as if they're not dirty, by putting out images of killed Palestinian fighters, it would be coming out through the informal Israeli channels. And as far as I know, we haven't seen it.
No, we haven't seen a Palestinian in any Israeli video yet, and we haven't seen signs of any kind of large scale casualties in a face to face fight. I mean, the IDF. Let's just use the IDF numbers: 5,000. Let's say it's 5,000. So there's still 35,000 more Qassam fighters, plus there's 10 other armed groups. According to the Israeli number just yesterday, they said that the Yahalom unit, their tunnels unit, has blocked 400 tunnel shafts. But they themselves say there's 1,300. And we know from the testimonies of the captives that were released that people are riding around on motorcycles in these tunnels. So let's get a bit of a grip on what the war actually would look like if you're going to try to eradicate Qassam. You're going down in a tunnel where they're riding around in motorbikes. So, I just think that the what we're watching is this brutal assault on civilians as a punishment for a military victory. Were these captives taken that we're seeing the women and children out of a battlefield? Like, was it that they were saving their lives by bringing them instead of having them attacked by helicopter gunships like we've done in our other reporting? So there's still a lot more to be known about October 7th. But what we do know about October 7th is that it was a stunning military defeat of Israel that they say is the worst since the Holocaust. And I don't understand from Israel's point of view why they want that. Why would you want to say that your sisters and your wives and daughters were somehow treated in a way that there's no proof they were treated? And why are they upset that their family and loved ones weren't tortured when they were held captive? Or why are they making such a big scene about how terrible it is that Qassam's showing these videos of them being released, being happy? You would think you'd watch and want your family members to be treated well. And that there would be some battlefield respect, that you would take care of your own soldiers and you take care of other soldiers because you care about your own soldiers. Palestinians are giving dignity and respect to these captives that aren't given to them in prisons.
Right.
But as a fighting force, Israel, normally a fighting force treats prisoners to some sort of standard, prisoners of war, because the presumption is that your people could be part of that too. And you want your people taken care of when they get captured. But there's none of that for Israel. They actually want to tell lies about what happened to their loved ones that didn't happen to them. When you just compare the brutality that we reported on for the first hour of this show, and then you compare it to just the humanity of the Palestinians under this circumstance, to even in the middle of a war, to even that Qassam, never mind the Israelis, that the Qassam fighters want to give a secret handshake to Itai. They're not worried about what that looks like or if their people will think that they're weak. They're just resistance fighters that their people think are heroes. And if you think that you're eradicating Qassam by this whole process, you're making the most popular political movement for decades to come. And look at the way that they're reacting, the way that they're treating people under this brutal circumstance. They're showing the whole world the juxtaposition between Israel and the people fighting for liberation. And if this is actually a war for liberation, like they said, there's going to be more war. And Qassam's ready for more war because they're not going to turn over those soldiers unless Israel is releasing thousands and thousands, if not all, of the prisoners. So I think the idea that somehow Palestinians can do something to avoid a next stage of war, it's not right. That's not how it works. It's Israel's not waiting for something and then they'll say, oh, okay, now it's enough. No, they're fighting a war for liberation. Everybody knows there's another stage coming. If it's not tomorrow, it's next week. And everybody knows that Israel's soldiers are not getting out of jail without thousands of Palestinians. And I don't like speculating, but that's one thing that I would be consistent on. They're not 3-to-1 exchanging soldiers. So there's going to be another phase of this war. And I don't think that we should believe that there's something Palestinians could do to avoid that. It would come even if they gave all the prisoners up. This is how Israel has handled this for 75 years of having a state and 25 years of armed struggle before that. So I think there's going to be another war, another stage of this war. And I think that it will fail too.
Yeah. Yeah, Israel is getting really good at failing, and we just hope they continue.
There's an inner thing in every man. Do you know this thing, my friend? It has withstood the blows of a million years and will do so to the end. It was born when time did not exist, and it grew up out of life. It cut down evil, strangling veins like a slashing, searing knife. It lit fires when fires were not, and burnt the mind of men, tempering leaden hearts to steel from the time that time began. It wept by the waters of Babylon, and when all men were a loss, it screeched in writhing agony, and it hung bleeding from the cross. It died in Rome by land and sword in defiant, cruel array, when the deathly word was Spartacus along the Appian Way. It marched with what the tailors pour, and frightened lord and king, and it was emblazoned in their deathly stir as ere a living thing. It smiled in holy innocence before conquistadors of old, so meek and tame and unaware of the deathly power of gold. It burst forth through pitiful Paris streets and stormed the old Bastille, and marched upon the serpent's head and crushed it neath its heel. It died in blood on buffalo plains and starved by moons of rain. Its heart was buried in wounded knee, but it will come to rise again. It screamed along by Kerry lakes as it knelt upon the ground, and it died in great defiance as they coldly shut it down. It is found in every light of hope. It knows no bounds nor space. It has risen in red and black and white. It is there in every race. It lies in the hearts of heroes dead. It screams in tyrants' eyes. It has reached the peaks of mountain high. It comes searing across the skies. It lights the dark of this prison cell. It thunders forth its might. It is the undauntable thought, my friend, that thought that says I'm right.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Bobby Sands, the Irish hunger striker, in his poem, The Rhythm of Time. And I think that captures, once again, the spirit that propelled both him and Rifat al-Arir to resist occupation and apartheid. So, one of the things I want to say about the John Elmer talk, when he was talking on the Electronic Intifada podcast, he was actually talking at the tail end of the seven-day ceasefire, which took place, or humanitarian pause, whatever BS term they used at the time, the seven-day pause at the end of November. I believe that was actually recorded on November 30th. Israel had yet to resume its bombing, and obviously we know it has, and thousands of people have been murdered since. More hospitals have been attacked, more atrocities, more schools have been bombed, more and more atrocities happen every day as the apartheid regime continues its genocidal rampage. But that had yet to happen, had yet to resume, I should say. When John Elmer was talking there, so if that that seems a little out of sync with what we're seeing now, I mean that's why they were still talking about prisoner exchanges and basically the way the Palestinians handled that, with so much more humanity than the Israelis were, and how that was a testament to what they were fighting for, what the Palestinians were fighting for. They're fighting for their liberation. And they will continue to resist. So from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. That's how it's going to be. Apartheid must fall. And this doesn't mean, the expulsion of the Jewish population or anything like that. This means everybody living together in Palestine under a single, not like a state which is there for everybody, exists for everybody, people of all faiths, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, they're all are there. All are respected. Apartheid's gone. Apartheid's smashed. It's done away with. That's what From the River to the Sea means, regardless of like all the BS you hear in the media saying it's a call for genocide and things like that. That's not what it is. The genocide, the real genocide, is what's going on with the right now in Gaza, as the Israeli apartheid state inflicts more and more pain and misery upon the Palestinian people there. But they continue to fight back, and they will, until liberation is gained. So, until next time, brothers and sisters, I want to say solidarity. Continue to stand with Palestine. And remember, Rafat al-Arir. Solidarity.
I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate. Small are the lives of cheats and of liars, of bigoted news press, fascist town crier. Deception annoys me, deception destroys me. The Bill of Rights froze me, in jails they all know me. Frustrated are churchmen, the saving of soul men, the tinker, the tailor, the colonial governor. They pull and leap on me, they're seeking to draw me away from the roundness of the light. Civil servants, they thrive off my body. Their trip is with power, back bacon and welfare. Police, they arrest me, materialists test me, pollution that chokes me, movies that joke me, politicians exploit me, city life that jades me. Hudson Bay fleece me, hunting laws freak me. Government is bumbling, revolution's rumbling. To be ruled in impunity is tradition continuity. I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man who thrives on hate.